From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells. Our next guest is Margaret O'Mara. Margaret is a professor of history at the University of Washington, but prior to her academic career, worked as a young person in the Clinton administration, which is where she saw the tie-in between technology, Silicon Valley, and government, namely defense. She's written a comprehensive book called The Code on the history of the high-tech economy and how Silicon Valley remade America. How has Silicon Valley been able to produce so many market-disrupting and world-changing companies? Well, Margaret O'Mara joins us now. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
It is great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, you had an enviable position in the Clinton White House that allowed you to view, have a real insight that most people wouldn't get into Silicon Valley and how it had already developed into such a tech capital by the 1990s. And can you just take us through a little bit of your experience, what you did?
Yeah, back in the 1990s, I was working in Washington. I was, you know, one of those young people that fuels makes Washington go. just watching as sort of incredibly momentous things are happening around me, including the rules of the road for the internet economy to come. There are so many incredibly consequential decisions that are made in Washington, that are made in collaboration with leaders of the tech industry, with also leaders of the telecommunications industry. At the time, those two industries didn't necessarily see alike about what the future, the wired future, was going to look like and who was going to control it. And one of the things that Silicon Valley successfully convinced leaders of both parties, lawmakers from both parties, of the importance of was that the internet, the early, you know, this is the dot-com years, right? This is really, really early on when you don't have people, you know, technology, software has not eaten the world as it has today. And they're saying, you know, the internet needs to be, we need to, let us regulate ourselves. Don't regulate us tightly like you would radio or television. We're not media. We're a place for free-flowing communication where you want to have lots of voices easily being able to have a voice and to create their own things, their own web pages, their own, you know, ways of communicating with one another. And Washington lawmakers agreed. And that was, at the time, the right decision, you know, that for what the industry looked like then. What it did is it enabled the growth of the internet as a platform. It enabled all of these voices to join in the conversation on the internet. But these laws, you know, the laws that are really kind of set in place what we have now were made, you know, Google didn't exist. Facebook hadn't created. I think Mark Zuckerberg was probably in middle school when all this conversation's going down, right? And now we're in a different world.
Absolutely. And now I know you probably cringe because you get this question a lot, and it's kind of a fun question. Did Al Gore really invent the internet?
No, he didn't claim, in his defense, he didn't really claim to. He kind of, you know, you know, the internet was the, you know, Silicon Valley didn't create the internet. The Department of Defense actually created the network that was the internet back in, that became the internet back in 1969. It's 50 years old today. But for the first three decades of its existence, it was this communications network for academic researchers who were working on different government funded projects or academic projects. There was no commercial activity. It was, you know, very limited. And in the early 1990s, it opens up. And one of the people, one of the few lawmakers who was instrumental in opening it up, as well as strengthening the computing, supercomputing backbone of the country, and creating capacity for, you know, this network to grow, is Al Gore. Al Gore is one of the few lawmakers in 1980s and 1990s Washington. Another one is another consequential 1990s politician, Newt Gingrich, who was paying attention to tech, paying attention to, you know, the trajectory of the industry. Both Gore and Gingrich are, you know, meeting with experts in supercomputing and asking technologists, you know, what the future is going to look like. Gore is forming close alliances with people in Silicon Valley and elsewhere pretty early on. And he's a big reason that Silicon Valley kind of gets so strongly aligned with the Clinton White House and with the Democratic Party more broadly in the 1990s.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Margaret O'Mara, who has written The Code, Silicon Valley and the Remaking of America. Margaret, you know, before Facebook, before Google, before the internet, way, way back, I got involved in Silicon Valley and working in the technology side, on the sales side of technology. And there were these silos, these big mainframe companies. There was Sperry Univac, and there was Honeywell, and there was IBM. And it was so exciting when the mini computer revolution started in the late 70s, where you could take smaller increments of processing power and bring that directly to the user. And then we all figured out, well, you know, we can network these things together, and maybe we can put disk drives with these things, and maybe we can put these types of peripherals. And then, of course, the whole PC revolution started. But those were really exciting days. And the landscape, the physical landscape of Silicon Valley looks different than it today than it did back then. It was more rural. It was more open. But there were just very, very exciting times. And before we got to Facebook, the internet, or any of these other companies that are so iconic today, this excitement went back, you know, sometime. So here's my question. All the different moving pieces of Silicon Valley, one of the pieces was the venture capital community. How would you compare and contrast the venture capitalist from the late 60s and the 70s to the venture capitalist today?
Oh, that's a great question. They've changed, just as the Valley has changed in its look and feel, just in the industries. But just as the different successive generations of computing technology built on the other, the venture capital industry also has built on itself. You know, VC, the early VCs, they come out of, a lot of them are former engineers and entrepreneurs. They come, they originally start working in companies, in semiconductor companies in the Valley in the late 50s and the early 60s. That's the first sort of great Valley, homegrown Valley cluster of industries is the semiconductor industry. And some of those executives and entrepreneurs go on to found some iconic venture capital firms. Kleiner Perkins, for example, is founded, co-founded by a veteran of Fairchild Semiconductor and a veteran of Hewlett-Packard, you know, people from previous tech generations. So they're fun, not only bringing money to, but also bringing entrepreneurial expertise and management expertise to these young entrepreneurs who are these, you know, technologists who don't know anything about how to run a company. So that's really what VC brings. And that continues to be today, but who they are is different. The first generation of Silicon Valley venture capitalists and technologists, for that matter, they were silent generation squares with crew cuts and white shirts and skinny ties. They were kind of spit and polish. You know, they were very closely aligned with the defense industry because the Defense Department and the U.S. government was the, you know, main patron and customer for a lot of these firms in the early days. You know, the Cold War and the space race were absolutely instrumental to launching these tech companies. Yes, they were for-profit private companies, and yes, they had enterprise, you know, private sector clients, but they also had the government was a really important customer and pretty essential to getting the flywheel going. So they're of this different generation, this different political sensibility. They tend to vote Republican. They tend to not be, you know, terribly political, you know. And the newer generation, you know, over time, you know, the politics changes, the generations change. That generation is replaced by kind of the baby boom generation that sees computing as this tool for empowerment, that is focused on personal computing and the kind of political project of changing the world through the free flow of information. And now, today, you have entrepreneurs and venture capitalists that are shaped by the current generation. A lot of the VCs and investors come out of companies like Google and Facebook. They've, you know, were made wealthy by the most recent generation of tech. They have a, you know, different generational sensibility. They have different ideas about how you, you know, grow and what the goals are that have been shaped by, you know, the companies that made them wealthy and made them powerful.
Yeah, exactly. And back to the mini computer revolution. I'm from Boston, so We had these three companies. You know, Ken Olson put Digital Equipment Corporation together. Ed DeCastro put Data General together, and we had Prime Computing, and then we had Wang. And they took Route 128, which sort of runs around Boston, and they called it the Technology Highway and Silicon Valley East. But then everything just sort of petered out. And I wanted to ask you, why did Silicon Valley happen in Silicon Valley and not Boston or some other location?
Yeah. Well, for a long, you know, Boston is a very big part of the story of this book, and kind of there's a symbiotic relationship between Silicon Valley and Boston that's sometimes forgotten. You know, a lot of people who came to Silicon Valley, they came from MIT, they came from Boston-based companies. There was plenty of examples of people from Stanford kind of bouncing back and forth to the other coast, and vice versa. But why does Silicon Valley happen in where it does? It happens because of defense spending that is disproportionately concentrated on the in the Pacific West. You know, you have these big defense economies that grow in the Bay Area, in L.A., in Seattle. And as part of that Bay Area defense economy in the peninsula, there was a cluster of industries building small electronics. The kind of anchor employer is Lockheed. Lockheed, you know, L.A.-based Lockheed opens its Missiles and Space Division, which is now mostly in Denver, but it opens in Sunnyvale, California in the mid-50s. It brings thousands of engineers to the valley and becomes this hub for a growing cluster of electronics industries, mostly East Coast-based electronics firms that open research labs around Stanford. Stanford conveniently builds a research park to house advanced industry and kind of recruit some of these companies to come out. Stanford was very entrepreneurial in kind of remaking its curriculum to meet the needs of the growing electronics industry, as well as to kind of persuade entrepreneurs to start companies in the vicinity and to bring their operations west. So that's, you know, the presence of Stanford, this very entrepreneurial university that is scrappy and trying to work its way up the prestige chain to be like MIT and Harvard, and the presence of defense contractor Lockheed and other electronics firms is really what makes the valley the valley.
So that brings us to two key figures in the formation of Silicon Valley, and I want to ask you about both of them. One is David Morgenthaler, who came from MIT. And can you just talk about his contribution? Because he started off in defense, I believe.
Well, he's a greatest generation. He's a you know, veteran of World War II. So David Morgenthaler is a wonderful figure. In part, one of the things I wanted to do in this book is not only to sort of reintroduce everyone to the people that you know, but also people you don't know who are very consequential. And one of the cool things is that the life of Silicon Valley is also parallels the lives of individuals. Morgenthaler is born in the 1920s. He goes to MIT in the 1930s in the depths of the Great Depression. He kind of comes out really wanting to do something entrepreneurial. His professors are like, oh, you need to go work for General Electric or some safe company. It's the Depression. There are no jobs. What are you thinking? You know, why would you go work for a small company? Before he has a chance to do that, World War II breaks out. He goes, spends 4 years in the service, and he has a ends up, you know, at age 24, kind of overseeing a battalion of hundreds, comes out, decorated war hero. And he really, his whole career really, really wants to move to California. I opened the book with him making a visit in the late 40s and trying to figure out how he can get a job there. And he realizes, you know, people tell him, well, there's really nothing going on here yet, or there's nothing here for you. You're too, you know, you're too senior. You need to go back east. So he goes back to Erie, Pennsylvania, where he was at the time working for a company. And what happens between 1949 and the years immediately after is that the whole valley turns around. It turns into this where there's a lot going on. There's a lot going on for the David Morgenthalers of the world. But people like Morgenthaler are also important because he becomes a venture capitalist. He starts in the venture capital business in the late 60s, like a lot of other former engineers and technologists and executives. They take the money they've made and they sort of pivot to become investors. And he becomes a mentor to generations of other companies. And this guy, born in the 1920s, war hero, World War II, greatest generation guy, he actually becomes an early investor in Apple. So you see these connective tissue between someone like Steve Jobs, who's seen as a very new generation person, and some of the older generation, like Morgenthaler.
Yes. So you say Morgenthaler came to Palo Alto for the first time in about 1949. So we have to remember that this is fully, you know, 22 years before some trade journalist names Silicon Valley, Silicon Valley. So it's quite a long period of time. But also you talk about the father of Silicon Valley, a Stanford professor, and this is the academic tie-in, Fred Terman.
Yes. Fred Terman is an extremely important figure. Fred Terman is a great example of how, you know, to explain Silicon Valley, you see there's kind of big top-down changes that are advantaging California, Northern California, the Pacific West in particular, like Cold War spending, the Pacific Theater of World War II, the Manhattan Project, which Terman works on. So Fred Terman is actually a Palo Alto born and bred kid. His father was a professor at Stanford. He goes to MIT for graduate school, electrical engineering in the 1920s. His mentor is a guy named Vannevar Bush. Vannevar Bush, who's at MIT throughout his career, he's a really fascinating figure who's an early character in the book. He's a co-founder of Raytheon, later becomes a major force in tech and defense contracting. During World War II, Franklin Roosevelt taps him to run this new Federal Office of Scientific Research and Development to hire thousands of academic scientists and engineers to work on the Manhattan Project and on other related scientific work, including development of digital computers, which is all towards, you know, to fight Hitler, to win the war. It was all in the cause of war work. Terman is one of the people that Bush recruits. He comes to Boston for the duration of the war, and while he's there, he realizes everything's about to change, that the federal government is going to start funding research in a way that it never has before, and money is going to flow to universities, and Terman wants his university, Stanford, to be in on the action. He wants to be named in the same breath as Harvard, which at the time it was not. And he successfully does that. He goes back and with other leaders of the university, including a historian who was its president, Wallace Stirling at the time. I always like to point out that Wally Stirling was a historian, so he's an important part of the whole story. Stanford remakes itself. It does something that really no other university, public or private, has done. It kind of builds up physics. It builds up all these labs. In creating what Terman called steeples of excellence in science and engineering. Of course, other things had to go by the wayside, so things like a public policy school and architecture kind of went away as freestanding programs. The French professors were not big fans of the humanities professors were not big fans of this pivot. But that turned Stanford into this incredible powerhouse and started building up these programs, undergraduate and graduate programs in engineering, and pumping out graduates who could start companies, who could go to work in companies, and that's the secret sauce.
Margaret, looking at the book, at the end of the book is a very substantial notes section, which I took a look at it, and you've done a tremendous amount of research for this book. I wanted to ask you, what most surprised you as you researched and put this book together?
I went in knowing that it was going to be a story in which government and business were intertwined. I was surprised by the different ways in which they were intertwined, and I actually was kind of surprised by I've been studying the At Valley for a really long time, and I'd been studying its Cold War history and then had not spent a lot of time in the more recent, the last 40 years of its history. And it kind of fallen into the, narrative of, well, there was all this government activity, and then it was supplanted by, the entrepreneurial, valley we know today. What surprised me in my research, in talking to people, in reading things, and going into archives, and also kind of doing oral histories, because interviews were a lot of what I relied upon on this book, was how much government and policy continued to be a transformative force and shaping force in the valley, an enabler in the valley in the 80s and the 90s and going forward. And in ways that were expected and unexpected, I found stories like when Steve Jobs went to Congress and spent 2 weeks lobbying, fruitlessly it turned out, for a tax break to allow personal computers to go into public schools, which turns out would have been a really great move for Apple. He's doing this in 1982. 2 years later, he does an interview with a reporter, and he says, "Yeah, I've never voted in my life, But the guy who never bothered to vote, who was seen as this apolitical figure, as so many of these tech moguls were, was going and lobbying Congress.
That's so there's this story.
Kind of hidden history of politics. And it's a fun history. It's great. It kind of gives you this twist on some of these people that you think of as these iconoclastic entrepreneurs. They're doing their own thing. They don't have any connections to old economy stuff and big government. And yet they do. And it was fun to unravel those stories. And I'm really delighted that I had the opportunity to bring the stories of the well-known and the less well-known to a broader readership.
Margaret, I have a theory for you I'd like to ask for your input on. And this may have changed from way back. It may be different today, but this is also based on my observations. It's not scientific, this theory. And that's that Harvard University, when you go to the B school, it's all about the CEO. And Stanford, and I know this is with a broad brush, but Stanford, it's more about the company and putting the whole thing together. My first startup company was East Coast based, and the CEO was from Harvard. And he made a lot of money when we went public, but we didn't, because they didn't share. And someone told me that they have this thing going on in Silicon Valley where they're much more open to sharing equity with the employees, and everyone gets a piece of the action. And so my next two startups were with them and were Silicon Valley based, and it was completely different because everything was really equity motivated. I mean, we needed to pay the light bill, and you need to have a salary to be able to do that. But they were a lot more open to sharing equity in the company. And back then, you would like to build a company and eventually go public, but it was an opportunity for everybody to be able to share. What do you think about that theory, East Coast versus West Coast?
Yeah, I think that's a very, really a powerful and important one. There are incredible, sort of many contrasts between East and West Coast, not only in what the two regions were specializing in, what they were focusing in, but also in the way sort of business infrastructure was growing. And in the Valley, that this business culture has a history, yes. This egalitarian kind of sharing the idea of stock options for everyone, really has its origins with Hewlett and Packard. Hewlett Packard, founded 1939, goes public 1957. Both Hewlett and Packard kind of embark on this, creating their company. First, they were creatures of the electronics lab. They were not, they were not Fortune 50. They didn't have a lot of management experience. But they were very consciously creating a company that was not going to be like the corporate behemoths of the day. They also were very anti-union. They saw labor unions as a sign that something was wrong with the company, if you had this antagonism between management and the rank and file. This has continued through the industry going forward. It's kind of interesting now that we have this activism within some of these big companies about the sort of labor activism, not necessarily unionization, but these companies kind of pushing back against management. But, sharing and creating, this creates a non-hierarchical, more flexible, ostensibly meritocratic system. But it also, I think, kind of makes Silicon Valley think it's a little more meritocratic than it actually is. It makes Silicon Valley companies sometimes overlook the fact that there are biases, there are hierarchies, there are things that are, people who are being left out of the bounty. One of the people I talk about in the book is a woman named Ann Hardy, who was, among other things, the designer and executive at a timesharing company called Timeshare in the mid-60s in Palo Alto. Timesharing is, the internet before the internet, how computers, getting computers to talk to each other, the mini computers being linked into remote teletype terminals so that people could tap into their power. And she designs the OS for the mini computer that powers Timeshare. And she's an executive, pretty high-level person, critical person to the company, kind of fundamental to the business. She does not get stock options that that make her rich when the company goes public. She is left out of that. So there's there is some selectivity there in that world that only not everyone gets to share in it. The people working on the assembly line and the fab plants and for semiconductors and in places like HP, they didn't get stock options. The blue collar workers didn't get stock options necessarily. There's an incredible sort of management story there that does, again, enable this fluidity. It was easy for people to go from one company to another in California. There were you didn't have non-compete agreements. That was prohibited, so you could just jump ship to a competitor without being penalized for it. That wasn't the case in Boston.
Margaret, we've got to let you go soon, and I wish we didn't because we could talk to you forever. But I want to just ask you one sort of broad question that actually could be made up of about a dozen little questions. But, you know, is there anything that we learned from the dot-com boom and bust that are lessons that could be applied today? Because as we know, all is not well in Silicon Valley in terms of, you know, stealing jobs in terms of automation and stealing our privacy and influencing our elections and things like that. Are there anything that you see that is a correlation or a lesson that can be learned from the dot-com bust?
I think there are a lot of lessons could be learned. I look anxiously at the indicators on as these companies go public this year. I'm like, wow, it seems kind of 1999-ish. You know, I think, look, the internet economy was a lot less mature than it is today, a lot less multifaceted. There was a lot of froth and a lot of really, really young companies and untested companies that were going public and having these skyrocketing valuations. But I think that there are lessons to be learned. You know, one of the things that made the dot-com boom and the bust happen the way it did is there, you know, in the 90s, there was a lot of money that was looking, a lot of cash that was looking for a home, and it found it in these tech companies. And the same thing has been happening lately. You know, you have a lot of these companies have these massive valuations and have been able to raise so much money before they go public because you have these big sovereign wealth funds. You have just a lot of money that's floating around needing a place to go and feeling like tech is a good bet. But there's also a lot of, you know, not discernible profit happening in some of these places. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, Amazon wasn't turning a profit. Amazon was a dot-com bust story. In 2001, you had analysts saying, sell, sell, sell. The people who sold their Amazon stock at that time, you know, had they held on to it until today, they would be pretty happy campers. So you never know what's going to happen. I think it's a matter of business leadership. It's a matter of playing a long game. I think one of the things that's made Amazon so durable and so dominant is that Jeff Bezos is always thinking 5 years in the future. He is playing a very long game. He has been building a data company since day one. It was an online bookseller, but really it was a it was the platform he was interested in, not the books.
Yep.
And so, you know, and that's in the later part of the book, I talk about the origin story of these, you know, the big five companies. And how they've evolved and why they've evolved and why they've become so dominant. And so the scale is different than the 90s. There are some, but, you know, tech does have a boom and bust cycle. That's what we do see from history, and not just the dot-com bust, but there have been previous ones. We're in a boom time now. This will, you know, calm down. The question, is it a bubble that will pop? Maybe, maybe not. But there will be, you know, not everything lasts forever, and no company is dominant forever. As much as technologists might not want to embrace that, no one will rule forever.
Mm. The book is The Code, Silicon Valley and the Remaking of America. Our guest is Margaret O'Mara. And thank you so much for joining us. Really great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Take care.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute. We'll be right back.